Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm today's host, Sufut Suamgyasan, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. So today we're going to cover one of the great secrets in sustainability science, something that's literally all around us, and yet we rarely look twice. Our cities are made of it, most physical infrastructure is made of it, and it represents the single largest mining type in the world. And yet there are huge gaps in our understanding of its sustainability implications and how society will be able to deal with its impacts in the future. I'm talking, of course, about the raw materials that make up concrete and building materials, sand and construction minerals. So I'm thrilled to welcome today's guest, Dr. Aurora Torres from the University of Alicante. So Aurora is a sustainability scientist focusing on the socio-ecological impact of society's consumption of sand, gravel, and construction minerals. And in 2017, Aurora wrote a landmark science paper drawing attention to the sustainability implications of a looming tragedy of the sand commons, which I know certainly had a really profound effect on me. It was one of those papers where you learn something that changes your perspective on the world around you. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. So Aurora now leads a set of international collaborations studying what could be thought of as the ecological economics of construction minerals, and was an expert author of a recent UN report on construction mineral sustainability. So Aurora, thanks so much for joining us.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me.
So Aurora, why should people care about concrete and construction minerals?
Well, in my opinion, construction minerals are the overlooked materials of the Anthropocene, and a key entry point is the dimension of the matter. Concrete is the most widely used human-made material, and the production of concrete and other materials such as mortar or asphalt relies on construction minerals. And since the 50s, their mining has increased dramatically due to population growth, urbanization, infrastructure development, and changing lifestyle, to the point that these minerals such as sand, gravel, and limestone have become the world's most extracted solid raw materials beyond fossil fuels and biomass. And they account for most of the world's anthropogenic mass, which as of 2020 outweighed all of Earth's living biomass. So these construction minerals are literally the foundation of modern society. And the bulk of those construction minerals are aggregates. And every year we use nearly 40 to 50 billion metric tons of sand, gravel, and crust rock. But sand is also used for the production of toothpaste, paint, ceramics, textiles, and even for energy production through fracking. It's really all around us. Now, despite construction minerals being considered in certain contexts as minor minerals because of their smaller relative value, they are actually strategic resources for every country because of the role they play in the built environment, satisfying societal needs for housing, transportation, industry, but also in the natural environment, maintaining biodiversity and providing a variety of ecosystem services such as the protection against flooding or filtering water. And one of the problems is that sand is a finite and non-renewable resource in human time scale. So the rapid growth in the demand has created challenges in terms of ensuring the supply of the materials, with growing concerns about sand scarcity, also fueling social conflicts and intensifying pressures on ecosystems. So satisfying a growing sand demand without transgressing planetary boundaries represents an important and insufficiently recognized sustainability frontier.
Amazing. And how did you end up studying this?
Well, it all happened towards the end of my PhD, and by then I was an ecologist that was tasked with investigating the impacts of urban and infrastructure development on wildlife and landscapes. So I was already quite aware about the unprecedented trends for this expansion of gray infrastructure since the Great Acceleration. But it was just 6 months before defending my PhD that I heard for the first time about the stealing of an entire sandy beach in Jamaica that has vanished in just a few days as thieves were stealing sand for the housing and the tourism sector. I remember just thinking how crazy is the world going, that this resource like sand was becoming scarce in some areas. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that in my research on the impacts of infrastructure, I had only been looking at the part of the picture, just the last step when the infrastructure is built or the on-site impact. But what about the indirect and the off-site impacts from the provision of construction minerals? So I convinced other colleagues to collaborate with me, and we started to investigate this issue, going through research and media reports. And we got to the conclusion that the world was facing a global sand crisis and that we knew very little about it.
So where does the sand that makes up our cities and infrastructure come from?
Well, there are two important considerations within that question. So first, it's about how what is sand and how we define it. And the thing is that sand is defined mainly by the grain size fraction. So any particles of any origin from 0.06 millimeters to 2 millimeters are considered to be sand, although we often refer to sand more collectively as aggregates, which are particles of different sizes. And this unconsolidated sand can be mined from terrestrial deposits, such as floodplains. It can be dredged from rivers and coastal areas, but it can be also produced mechanically by crushing rocks. And there is a variety of rocks that we can use for this purpose, such as sandstone or limestone, but also secondary materials such as concrete. So sand comes from a variety of primary and secondary sources, and the sources vary depending on where we are. So for example, in Europe, the most consumed type of construction aggregates is crushed rock from quarries. Now, many people might be also wondering about desert sand because it's kind of an obvious candidate. However, the grains of sand in the desert have been eroded by wind and are very round and smooth and are also very well shorted. All the grains are very similar to each other, which creates problems for many applications in concrete production. Now, going back to your question on where does the sand that makes up our cities come from, there is the aspect of traceability. How can we know the geographic origin of sand resources and whether they come from ethical and responsible sources? And although these type of tools are very encouraged by organizations, the traceability of sand and other construction minerals in supply chains is still very weak and overall at an emerging state. One of the traceability tools that we are exploring in a research led by the University of Texas is the use of traditional techniques in sedimentology for tracing these sand supply networks from the mining sites to the consumers. And the thing is that the naturally occurring sand inherits a compositional fingerprint from the geology of the catchment where it comes from. And there is a variety of provenance analysis techniques that can be used to study these natural sediment dispersal patterns that have been applied also to forensic geology and archaeology for getting to know the provenance of sand at a crime scene or of artifacts. So one could easily imagine how these techniques can be applied to study the traceability of sand through supply networks. And we recently published a preprint on this work, developing a proof of concept in controlled conditions in Texas. And now we are aiming to expand these efforts towards other conflict areas such as Southeast Asia.
Yeah, that sounds incredibly cool. So what are some of the ecological and social impacts of society's hunger for sand and construction minerals?
Well, the direct impacts from the removal of these materials is usually very localized, but the indirect impacts can be more serious and can affect ecosystems far outside the boundaries of the extraction site for decades into the future. For example, through the erosion, from landslides to riverbank collapse, or sinking deltas, such as in the case of the Mekong Delta. We can also observe an increased amount of suspended materials, salinization, air pollution, and increased traffic and noise level near the mining sites or the transportation routes. So as a result of this degradation, there is a wide range of species that are threatened by this type of activity, from river dolphins to crocodiles or turtles. And the degradation of ecosystems can also cascade into the human system and affect the provision of ecosystem services, affecting the access to drinking water that may suffer from the lowering of the water table. There might be issues with pollution, salinization or the provision of wild and cultivated food sources. It can also undermine the protection against natural hazards, such as a storm or tsunamis. And it was concluded that the extensive sand mining that was going on in Sri Lanka before the Indian Ocean tsunami maximized the impact. And it can also impact our health, with several publications highlighting a higher prevalence of diseases like malaria and other vector-borne diseases in areas where there is sand mining going on. But it's also important to highlight that mining can also bring valuable incomes for many members in the local communities, many of which are artisanal miners dedicated to this activity. So overall, the impacts are quite complex and it's hard to generalize and it's all very context dependent. However, it's important to recognize that where there is mineral extraction, there will be always impacts on ecosystems. So we need to accept this to take actions to avoid any unacceptable damage and minimize, restore, and compensate for the impacts.
What are the kind of mechanisms through which sand mining might contribute to malaria?
So what happened is that in certain areas where there is mining going on, it's common to find standing water pools that are perfect breeding grounds for mosquitoes, like the mosquitoes transmitting the malaria. So if this is the case in an area where there are diseases like malaria going on, there is an increasing prevalence. Although it's also complex because to some extent, the improved building materials and the improved quality of the houses that are built with concrete in comparison with other more traditional building materials might also contribute to decrease to some extent the prevalence of malaria. So as I was saying before, it's all very context dependent.
It's crazy there are these such tight interconnections between the ecological system and the human system and all bound together by sand. So you recently published a preprint quantifying the species threatened around the world by sand and construction mineral mining. What were the key takeaways of that work?
Well, I think this paper contributes to advance our understanding of the global biodiversity burden associated with construction minerals, which is vastly understudied. And in particular, in this work, we combine two data sources, long-term data from the IUCN Red List and data of the description of new species to provide the first systematic evaluation of the species threatened by mining of construction minerals. And we found that during the last decade, the mining of construction minerals have become an increasingly salient threat to biodiversity, being increasingly reported. And specifically, this activity has contributed to 4 known species extinction and has impacted at least 1,000 species of those that have been assessed by the Red List, of which almost 60% are threatened with extinction. However, given that the Red List has assessed the status of only 8% of the known species, we believe that the total extent of this threat may have reached over 24,000 animal and plant species. And our assessment also flags threats on understudied taxonomic groups and endemic species with impacts that vary also, again, across mining contexts. And for example, while rock quarrying mostly threatens biodiversity of karstic systems and species with very small rain sizes, sand and gravel extraction in river and coastal areas is a more prominent threat to species occurring in those aquatic ecosystems.
So, I mean, that sounds like a really intense fingerprint on our wildlife. How is demand projected to change in the future?
Well, the available projections indicate that the demand will likely double in a few decades, mostly driven by population growth, urbanization, and infrastructure development in Asia and Africa. But still, there is considerable growth that is also expected in North America and Europe because we keep growing our consumption per capita of material due to changing lifestyle, so that our lifestyle is now more resource intensive. And for example, the floor area per capita is expected to double from 2017 to 2060. There is also a trend towards declining household size and towards increasing urban sprawl that are making our consumption of natural resources in general less efficient. And in addition to these drivers, climate change will likely amplify the demand for construction minerals. On one hand, for mitigation and adaptation, especially in areas where climate change is projected to cause more extreme weather events, like is the case of coastal regions, where it might be necessary to create coastal flood defenses, redirect infrastructure investment farther inland to facilitate migration to flood-safe areas. And on the other hand, we expect more rapid concrete and asphalt degradation with increasing temperature and CO2 concentration, which shorten the lifetime of these materials and increase the demand for the repairing and renovation of buildings and infrastructure. So in the end, there is a reinforcing loop with climate change that contributes to increased material consumption and which leads directly and indirectly to more greenhouse gas emissions with the risk of undermining sustainability efforts.
Yeah, I remember it was only a few weeks ago I was reading an article about the way that the Maldives is adapting to climate change by essentially pumping a lot of concrete, by raising the level of the islands through concrete infrastructure. So this sounds like a really big threat to biodiversity. And the question is, why are construction minerals so hard to govern? Why are these problems so hard to solve?
Well, many of these unconsolidated deposits of sand and gravel are vulnerable to tragedies of the commons because they're basically open to all. You cannot put a fence to sand. They are easy to extract and to transport. Sometimes you just need a bucket and a shovel and a truck for transporting the sand, and therefore it's very difficult to regulate, especially when the demand changes rapidly. If the demand remains slow, this might not be such an issue. And for example, I have seen places in Mexico, in the Usumacinta River, where there are cooperatives extracting and managing rivers and resources in an apparently good balance with the sediment dynamics of the river. Now, everything could change very quickly with a rapid spike in the demand and with an urgency to provide materials and with them becoming more profitable and attractive as a source of income. So then we can start seeing how the mining activity expands and intensifies in a more disorganized and uncontrolled way. And another important factor is that the industry is dominated by small and medium-sized companies. Just keep in mind that the top 10 producers combined represent less than 5% of global production. And in fact, the sector is largely informal in many countries. Now, it's important to distinguish here between informal mining and illicit or illegal mining. And we speak about informal mining when it's more socially accepted or tolerated by the members of the communities. And we talk instead about illicit supply networks that have emerged in some countries when sand becomes more profitable and people use criminal approaches to minimize cost. For example, the use of violence, the overexploitation of the local communities, or they use the interactions among contractors, politicians, and corrupt policemen to develop this activity. And for example, in India, the attacks on government officials, journalists, environmental defenders standing against some mafias, they pile up and hundreds of people have been killed in recent years. And connected to that problem is that the spatial information of where mining is going on is very poor. There are no global maps of where is this mining activity occurring, despite this being the biggest mining endeavor, and with thousands of operations just in a single country, for example, just in the US or in China. Even in high-income countries, there are serious deficiencies in the reporting of mining rights and the associated spatial information. And finally, it's just the fact that construction minerals, and in particular sand and other aggregates, are given for granted. For every development, it's just assumed that there will be minerals available and a careful planning on the best deposits to exploit based on economic, environmental, and social concerns is often missing.
Yeah, this whole situation is just totally crazy. I remember when I first read your paper, and it just opened my mind to these crazy stories appearing all around us for this material I was completely taking for granted. So just so listeners can get an understanding of how this all works in practice, do you mind talking us through a real-world case study of the impact of sand and gravel extraction in a real-life socio-ecological system?
Sure. So I think in recent times, nowhere in the planet has been the extraction of construction minerals more dramatic as in China, which has consumed in 3 years more cement than the US did in the entire 20th century, and whose consumption today represents still almost half of the global consumption of construction aggregates. And it's interesting because we have observed several transitions in the last years in this country. The rapid urbanization and infrastructure development in China first skyrocketed the demand for sand and other construction minerals. And while initially mining was more concentrated near the markets, such as in megacities in the coastal areas, there were at some point increasing restrictions pushing farther away the mining activity towards the interior of China. That is the case, for example, of the Poyang Lake, which is the country's largest freshwater lake. And for several years, it was also the biggest sand mining operation in China. But at some point, the intense extraction drastically changed the geomorphology of the lake and compromised its ecological integrity, affecting terrestrial and aquatic biodiversity and also fisheries. So these concerns about the environmental impacts and also mineral shortages that were becoming more intense with such a high demand led to more strict regulations that contributed to increase the price of river sand by up to 600%, leading to a massive illegal mining activity in the Yangtze River economic belt that was really hard to disrupt for the government. And this was one of the main reasons why China experience and promote a transition from mining sand from rivers to mountains, with many policies approved in the last few years that promote the development of mega quarries to produce crust rock, which has now become the dominant source of aggregates in the country. And although it's considered that most of the extraction happened at the domestic scale, and that is the case of China or the US, for example, with a share of the international market representing just around 1%. There are also exceptions to this, particularly in small-sized countries with intensive human land uses that have difficulties to approve new mining license. And that is the case of Singapore, which has been in several geopolitical conflicts with the neighboring countries and was even accused of the disappearance of 24 islands in Indonesia and of the over-exploitation of countries such as Cambodia. So this has become quite a sensitive issue in the area.
Yeah, those are some incredible stories. So what are the solutions for meeting future demand for concrete and construction minerals from urbanization and things within ecological constraints?
Well, that's quite a difficult question. And I think that as with climate change, there is not a single solution, but multiple entry points for promoting a more sustainable consumption. So I think in general, if we only focus on the mining side, we might get an incomplete picture of the problem and our solutions might lead to shifting the problem somewhere else. So central to all is to take a broader look at the entire sand supply network of a region to gain this holistic understanding of the opportunities and impacts of different mining and supply streams across time and space. And overall, meeting a growing demand while minimizing the damage requires us to be smarter and more strategic. For example, through a good knowledge of the reserves and available alternatives within a given region, promoting a solid regulatory framework, a strong monitoring system, and coordination among multiple actors, always adjusting to the complexity of each context. But we for sure need to avoid unnecessary consumption of natural resources in the construction sector. That's at the top of the list of available solutions, because not every new urban or infrastructure development project deliver both economic and social gains. So we really need to check any new development very carefully. And regarding material efficiency efforts, I think the strategy should focus on closing the loop of production to move towards a more circular economy that reduces our dependence of natural system. For example, by extending the lifetime of buildings and infrastructure, making lighter buildings with less amount of concrete, or designing for easy disassembly and reuse of building components, and sometimes also using substitutes such as engineered timber or recycled construction and demolition waste. Now, it's interesting because there is a report that was published by the International Resource Panel in 2020 arguing that increasing material efficiency to reduce climate change impacts and overall to reduce material consumption is technically possible based on the technologies available today and will contribute to economic growth and job creation. However, the report reveals an uncomfortable truth, which is that the most influential strategies are not technical, but social. So those strategies should focus on reducing material demand per person, meaning a more intensive use of buildings, or less construction of infrastructure that's highly environmentally or socially damaging. So that requires a societal transformation towards less material intensive lifestyle, which swims against the tide of ongoing global trends of urban sprawl and increasing floor area per capita. But it's crucial to be aware about this, about that the greening of production alone will not reduce emissions and other environmental impacts sufficiently, and that if we continue like this, we might be eating up what we gain through technical measures to increase material efficiency. So in the end, the future of sun resources and the natural and human communities that depend on them is tied to the direction that we as society take in the Anthropocene.
Yeah, and that is a message that will resonate with a lot of the ecological economists who are listening to this podcast, of course. And yet another link with the kind of wider ecological economic literature, I think, is that construction minerals are yet another multi-billion dollar extractive industry. So are there any environmental justice implications of relevance to ecological economics?
Absolutely. I think we often see an unequal distribution of benefits with the environmental degradation that is brought or reinforced by the mining activity, creating a burden on those that are more vulnerable in the communities. Many of those are women that, for example, have to travel longer distances for accessing drinking water, good or medicinal plants because of the deforestation of riparian habitats. So this situation or this burden might lead to the migration of people from eroding or degrading areas or to resistance movements. And for example, there are about 80 conflicts in the Global Atlas of Environmental Justice that is coordinated by the Universitat Autónoma de Barcelona that are connected to the exploitation of construction minerals, either in rivers, coastal areas, and mountains. And some of these include reports of illicit activity and murders of journalists and environmental defenders protesting against mining of construction minerals, with cases from Mexico, Turkey, Kenya, China, Cambodia, among many others.
Yeah, it's a really, really terrifying burden on, you know, the social systems and on environmental defenders. So over the last couple of years, recognition of this kind of issue has been increasing. And do you mind talking us through some of the initiatives that have arisen in the last few years to address the sustainability of sand and construction mineral consumption?
So from a point of view, there has been an interesting evolution. It's not that sand as a resource has been fully ignored until now. There were regulations and guidelines that to some extent affected or considered sand resources. But in the last decade is when we really have started to gain the perspective of sand and other construction minerals as a strategic resources due to their economic, environmental, and societal value. And also we have become more aware about the global challenges with multiple and diverse problematics emerging across the world. And I think the journalists have played an instrumental role in bringing to light many conflicts and stories across the world. I remember, for example, in 2013, the documentary Sand Wars by Denise Delestrac opened the eyes of many people. And during this decade, the initial efforts from organizations and researchers were more of wake-up calls, bringing attention to the impacts from extraction, over-exploitation, and during this time, we started to talk about a global sand crisis or how to avoid a global sand crisis. And in the last 5 years, I feel that we have entered a phase of action. So the research interest in this topic has accelerated on many fronts, from investigating the impacts of mining on rivers and deltas to finding alternative materials such as byproducts of other industry, or understanding the biodiversity impacts of how sand resources are governed across the world. Also, there are international organizations, journalists, civil society groups, governments, and companies that have started to place this topic on the environmental political agenda. And for example, with three resolutions of the United Nations Environmental Assembly adopted recently that directly address the issue of mining construction minerals. And just in 2020, the United Nations Environmental Program launched the Global Sand Observatory as an initiative for developing knowledge and providing decision-making support on the sustainability issue of sand extraction and use. And an important milestone of this observatory, to which I had the honor of contributing, was the publication of the report Sand and Sustainability, 10 Strategic Recommendations to Avert the Crisis, that was published last year as a call for action with very specific recommendations for policymakers to start the necessary transformation in our institution, businesses, and societies on how we manage and use sand resources, for example, by adopting relevant policies and standards, promoting best practices, and this type of initiatives.
I don't know, this has been such an interesting conversation, and I really can't thank you enough. But we'll finish off with the question we ask all our guests. What is your rebellion?
So I think my rebellion is really about going back to the basics of what being a scientist means to me, and that is producing knowledge that can help us understand and navigate these complex environmental and sustainability challenges that our planet is facing. I think that our consumption of sand is outstripping and our understanding of the environmental impacts and the social effects. And this is leading often to unbalanced views in which environmental and social concerns are diminished in favor of economic goals that ignore the planetary limits and boundaries. So we need to be more aware that cities, roads, and artificial islands do not exist in isolation from the natural world. And we need to do a much better work to account for these externalities. At the end, it's not just about finding replacement materials. The rebellion is about making a more intelligent and responsible consumption of the world's natural resources.
Well, thank you so much to Dr. Aurora Torres, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us.
Thank you, Sofus, and goodbye to everyone.
Stay tuned with us for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.